It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And today's conversation focuses on women in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, if you didn't know what STEM stood for. And with us today are Dr. Jill Patel, a neuroscientist, and Anna Eglin, experienced designer. And we have Dr. Julia Hum, who's an associate professor, assistant professor of physiology, and Dr. Crystal Morton, who's associate professor of mathematics. And you're all connected because Jill did something I think pretty amazing, and that was to bring examples of women who could serve as role models for other women and girls who might be thinking about a STEM field. Jill, you want to give us a little taste of why you brought people together and what your motivation was?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've had this idea for several years now, but I think I had started thinking about this since I was way younger, because I have always been interested in science. And that's been, you know, probably since high school, I thought I'm going to be a scientist or something close to that. There's a lot of different things to navigate just in that career path. But then when I actually got into my undergrad, and I did my undergrad in biochemistry and then advanced to my graduate degree, but in just the undergrad, I already started experiencing basically what I'd call setbacks or challenges, or even just observations from how different it is for women to go past the same exact degree or education, but have a very unique set of problems that they face. And so I found almost every single time I gravitate towards other women, people in my class or, you know, even my family members, it's always, I go to women for advice, or even just event. And I think the reason behind that is we all have a similar set of experiences, even if you're not in STEM, but especially if you're in STEM. And that kind of has helped me a lot to even just like be able to get past my undergrad and then go into my grad school. And then that's a whole other story, but I really enjoyed being able to talk to other women, get advice, get, you know, other people's stories on how they managed or overcame their sets of challenges. And so my idea was we should just make this a very, very common, easily accessible set of stories that women would be able to share. And it'd be very personal to them, but I feel like it would easily be able to help someone who was like me starting in undergrad or even high school and be able to find some sort of community that would ease the experience of being a woman in STEM.
Yeah, and you know, each of you really, as I look at what you're each specializing in, is really those have been traditionally men-dominated areas. Some of them still are. And Anna, I know that in technology, it's one of the really hard areas that we've had to break through. You want to talk about your experience with that? And I know you've got a new venture. You can talk about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, technology is interesting. I think definitely it's like traditionally, well, originally it was actually, you know, women in the field. Like women were the original coders. They were the original, right. Until, you know, that was always considered women's work until, you know, one day, I think like in the 60s or 70s, that all changed. But I think in tech, yeah, I mean, when you're looking at development or like the coding, like that is traditionally, you know, very, very male dominated. I think we're starting to see a lot more roles for people out. I mean, tech is so much more than development. There's so many more other supporting roles around it, a lot more creative roles that are not just that. So I think where in tech, I think where we really, really need to have more underrepresented people is kind of in leadership, because we see all of these tech companies, you know, majority of them are started, founded, run by white men. They have these great exits, and then they continue to take that money and they fund other white men who build other tech companies, and they're and just continuing to build kind of tech for themselves. And I think we've seen a lot of the harm that that can do when you have a really homogenous group of people building, you know, infrastructure changing technologies. And so I think that's kind of the next big frontier. I think we're seeing a lot more women represented in the lower levels of tech, but getting up those totem poles, getting in those leadership positions, starting those companies, and just getting funding. I mean, just so much funding doesn't go to women, doesn't go to people of color, especially women of color. And so I think that those are the biggest challenges we see right now in tech, is just leadership and funding. That's two huge, huge problems.
Yeah, and it's sort of that behind the scene stuff that still goes on in institutions. And when we talk about systemic things, but it's more than sometimes systemic. It's I mean, that's in the system, but it also is something that's almost, it's I hate to use that phrase, but it's the good old boy syndrome. In other words, somebody you know, befriends another person who befriends another person, and it just gets a cycle going to where it isn't there. I know, Julia, you're nodding your head. I know the area that you're in, again, in physiology and those areas, but you've had to break through some kinds of barriers as well.
Well, and just to echo what Anna said, you know, in my world, it's the health disparities. So we're at Marion University trying to train the future of healthcare, right? And whether it be nurses, doctors, you know, exercise scientists, biomedical researchers, right? And making the public aware that that's a spectrum. I think the pandemic has certainly highlighted that, you know, there's outside of doctors and nurses, there's a lot that goes into critical care and vaccine development, and all of that is healthcare related. And, you know, so for me personally, not only is it, you know, helping women succeed through their training to become mostly clinicians is where I focus my efforts, but also people of color into that STEM pipeline. We all are well aware of the health disparities, and one way of addressing that is to increase the amount of particularly people of color, women of color that are on the front line of healthcare. And just this week, actually, I just came from our healthcare camp. We at Marion this week are starting our inaugural 1 week long healthcare camp for high school students. It's funded in part by the Tom and Julie Wood Family Foundation. And it really goes to try to increase the perceptions of high school students of the diversity of careers in healthcare, with hands-on experiments, that literally experiments they're doing, as well as experiences, so they can see that there's things at the lab bench that they can do all the way to the clinic. And on Friday, they'll actually get to do their first simulated patient encounter. You know, so these high school students are gonna, you know, work together to diagnose an asthmatic and what that means to give a bronchodilator. And so it's really exciting. But you know, I think we've slowly, at least in medicine, started to identify some of those key inequities. And it doesn't start at medical school, because as we all know, you know, even getting into medical school is just terrifically challenging. We need to start, you know, in grade school and high school and really molding those minds to the career possibilities as well.
Yeah, that's great. Crystal, I know being an associate professor in mathematics education is a really unique role. Women, though, have been really strong in the past. Anna, you even hinted at it, early coders the roles of women early on in mathematics, but we do see kind of a drop off. So what kinds of things are you working on, Crystal, with in education to help change the way we seem to lose girls about third grade or so?
Yeah, so and when you talk about representation in education, you know, we predominantly have white women in the classroom. So they, you know, but when you look at specifically at STEM teachers, particularly looking at mathematics in my area, you find that you may have fewer women and definitely fewer women of color across the field. So one thing that I think we need to do is to make sure that we have teachers, as Julia was just saying, we have to start in the lower grades and making sure that we have teachers in classrooms that believe in the brilliance of all students. And so my work centers on Black girls, and research shows that Black girls are, you know, they're stereotyped, they're pushed out of mathematics at an early age because they're deemed as not being able to learn. And so that's what students are dealing with. And if you're getting that from grade school on, you know, why would you want to stay in a field where it's truly violence against you? So I believe that it's crucial that we have teachers in classrooms that believe in the brilliance of students. And part of that is making sure that we diversify the STEM teaching field. And at IUPUI, we have a grant through the National Science Foundation where we're working to increase the number of teachers in STEM field, and then particularly increase the number of teachers of color in STEM field. And so having scholarships in place and supports that can start, you know, as soon as you graduate from high school and getting supports your first year of school, getting individuals into the classrooms early so that they can see that teaching is something that could be a very viable and fulfilling career for themselves. What we wanna hopefully do is to secure funding to do work, more work in high school with teacher cadet programs, and then going down to the middle schools to really get them interested in teaching, get them interested in STEM teaching in particular, and understanding that it is a viable career. They have the brilliance to do it. And it is a way that we can serve everyone, because all of the, you know, every part of STEM starts with the teacher. And oftentimes when we talk about STEM careers, we don't talk about education. And so it's like, we really have to put education central when we're having these conversations around STEM and STEM careers. So I just really think it starts with having teachers who believe in the brilliance of all students, making sure they have that early, as you're talking about, the early hands-on experiences within STEM fields, and that just understanding how it relates to their lives. And I believe that will keep them engaged and willing to persist when you do have those challenging times, especially being a woman of color going through higher education in STEM areas. And then we'll probably talk later about what's at the end of this pipeline we're always talking about.
Right. You know, Crystal, and this, I think, affects all of you, but I mean, you hit upon something really important. It's beyond just the delivery of the content to someone, you know, and yes, we can have a person that's a white teacher and deliver the content, but there is something about seeing oneself as well as a role model or an example of someone. So having a more diverse teaching staff from elementary on up, I think, is critical.
Yeah, and I will also say, in addition to the teaching staff, also the curriculum. I mean, when I went through mathematics was all white men, you know, not to mention a woman, and definitely not to mention a woman of color. But when you have a curriculum that you never see yourself, I mean, that can have an impact. So it's important that we diversify the STEM field. It's also important that our curriculum looks very different than it looks right now.
Yeah, that's great. You know, several of you mentioned the idea of work during our pandemic and that kind of thing. And I read a really alarming statistic, which was a lot of women who were in, and all of you are in research areas or leaders in that, but a lot of women, because of the roles that we have a lot of times, their research suffered because there wasn't childcare. There was a whole lot of things which puts a ding in the, you know, the system is about publishing and research and all that. And now you get people put behind again when we had the pandemic. Anybody want to take that one on? Why do we still still put women in that role predominantly. There are men that do, but I mean, but we still have a significant amount of women who that became their role during the pandemic, was to manage being at home and a career at the same time. And being at home, meaning being the teacher at home.
So I was reading that article I think there are several out, but the one I was reading collected data that looked at the number of articles or journal papers that were published or even submitted throughout the pandemic, and then compared to the same time last year, and then compared within like the few months within the pandemic. And I think the striking part was that there, when you look at females versus males that are somewhat advanced in their careers, there wasn't much of a difference, meaning that the ones that suffered the most were early career female scientists who had younger kids at home, or even like elderly family members to take care of. And those were the ones that, for some reason, even though maybe both partners would be at home, if it's, you know, a heterosexual couple, it ends up being the female that is going to be taking care of kids and teaching them and doing, you know, household chores and stuff like that. And I don't know if there was, that's all the article referred to. So I think it'd be hard for me to understand the exact reasoning behind it. But I think it has to do with the culture of just like how much women, especially in STEM careers that are working really hard, the same amounts of hours as men in their same, not only fields, but the positions that they're in, they all work pretty much the same amount of time. But from what I know, women then have to go home and take care of a lot of different things that somehow does not really fall. And I think that's it's the very like cultural socialization of like, these are the gender stereotypes, these are the things that women have to do, and this is what men do. And so, you know, in the pandemic, it was, you're at home all the time. And how do you figure out how many hours you're going to commit to your work versus how many hours do you spend with your family? Because they're all right there. Like there are no boundaries. There was no physical separation of work versus home life. And I think a lot of that has to do with just the way that the culture here is set up, where it's not as supportive of women in STEM. And that's kind of just how it's become. And I don't know if anyone else wants to comment on this. I read a lot about this and I've talked to people, and that's pretty much how I formed the opinions, but I feel like other people here might have more.
Jahil and Mark, I think the first time you and I spoke was like in the midst of that. Like it was probably April or May, I believe, or probably May or June, about a year ago this time. And sometimes I feel like our family could be case study A of what you're describing, Jahil. And so while I can't speak to other people's experiences, you know, as a woman in a heterosexual marriage, and my husband is an attorney, the courts never shut down, you know, and so he could remote in and still was expected to remote in. And I think the odd part of the pandemic is we were all trying to figure that out, right? Like, what does all of our works look like now, given this remote factor? But yes, I think our culture is predominantly the default parent, which is a term I learned in the pandemic, is usually a woman. And I think that's why you see, I read that exact same study about the fall off of papers being published, particularly by early career women scientists. And it's, you know, it's heartbreaking, you know, because you know what as a scientist, I know what a critical time, pre-tenure, you know, to get those grants and those key publications out. Speaking only for myself, who's at more of a primarily teaching institution, where it's very important to get publications out for our students, right? For them to get their residencies and get into a great PhD program. You know, we just had to be very flexible, and we tried to mold some of our research, what we could turn into either database combing or survey research. We had to adjust on the fly. And as a trained, you know, bone molecular biologist, that was a real switch for me. But, you know, we're all bright people, you know, and we're in the STEM field. And so that was just an additional challenge. But having our three little ones at the time at home, luckily only one was school age. So she was the only one that was in a curriculum, and it was kindergarten. So I can't speak to, you know, like a middle school, sixth grade, you know, how do you teach sixth grade Spanish at home? You know, I have no idea. But it was quite challenging, and made me, I could feel my patience just getting shorter and shorter. And by the time it was really short at breakfast, I was like, you know what? I think I might need to reach out to somebody. And I found a really helpful therapist through all of that. but I don't have an answer just like you as to why, but my own family, is an example of that, where dual career, young children, and we just tried to make it work, and we kind of tag teamed, and my husband took over night shift, and I did most of the day, and I worked mostly at night, and he worked mostly during the day, and you went into survival mode. But personally, I didn't feel like, oh gosh, I have to do this because I'm the woman. It was what at the time I was like, gosh, I need to do this for our family, right? And you went into, this is just what we're gonna have to do. But that only lasts so long. Like I said, the patience got short quick. And so we had to figure out other ways of balancing responsibilities.
Yeah, I think it is a lot of the cultural norms, and I don't, we in a society that really was set up for white men. I will say though that, you know, coming out of or through COVID in a different way, that we need to think about, you know, the systems we have in place. I mean, one thing I did appreciate about IEPUI is we did have an option with our third year review that was, well, not annual review post COVID, that there was, you have like I think it was a letter or something you could fill out to talk about how COVID has impacted your work, and that to be taken to consideration. And so I know that IU was, you know, offering opportunities if you went through going off a tenure and you wanted to wait, you could do that because of the impact of the pandemic. So I appreciate those things being in place, but I really think it comes down to, you know, now you do have, you know, I'm not, you're talking about a scientist and going to medical school, that these things can impact your career trajectory, but it's stepping back to say, okay, what do we do with this year and a half? It doesn't mean you lower the standards, but how do we change the standards? And when you're even thinking about those changes, it might be change that you need to consider moving forward. Women, by nature, we bear kids. I mean, I don't have kids of my own, but women are producers, they carry kids. So these are things that's been happening since the beginning of time. You know, there should be structures in place for that. And so hopefully this could be a time where we really look at to how do we change these systems, where it's taken into account that not everybody is a male that's in these spaces.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Jill.
I was just gonna add to what Crystal said, because I 100% agree. And I've heard this before, and I think it resonates, that these issues were always there, and that the pandemic has basically just, it's exacerbated it so much that people are like, oh wow, we now have data to show you, because within just 1 year we've seen all these changes happening. And I think that the way forward is, now you have some data on it, what are you going to do about it? And so yeah, the childcare, I've always thought about, like, you know, companies that offer childcare on the actual campus or building, that's a very simple solution that you can do at universities, for example. So that's there's a lot of like easy solutions, not really easy, but, you know, simple solutions that you could implement now that you have a bit more data and quantitative information about what's going on.
And I would say with that childcare, making sure that it's accessible to all. I mean, we do have childcare on campus, but you should look at the affordability of it, because we're sitting here thinking in positions of, you know, maybe faculty members, but you have some that are staff members who are in these situations as well. So from whomever's on the lowest end of the pay scale to the highest end of the pay scale, would need to have access to that quality childcare, because it will make a huge difference and give people the amount of time they need to be off. I mean, so that's important, and not penalizing them for that.
We've been talking with four amazing women who are working on to not only further their own careers in a STEM field, but those encourage others and serve as role models for those girls and for women who might be coming along in that same path. And so we've been talking with Jill Patel, Anna Eglin, Julia Hum, and Crystal Morton, and more of our conversation after a short break.
Hi, this is Toni Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about women in STEM with Dr. Jill Patel, Anna Eglin, Dr. Julia Hum, and Dr. Crystal Morton. And sometimes I get alarmed when I hear things, and this is not just in Indianapolis, but across the United States, that in the way we go about encouraging people to get excited about learning science or to get excited about technology or mathematics, sometimes it takes a big backseat to the most boring ways that you could do to present that material and content. And so it surprises me that actually almost anybody wants to go into it sometimes, when, and you've all had that experience, with how it's presented to you, not only as a young child, but as you go through high school. Julia, I know you're involved at the academic level, and you see a lot of this where people come to you and they don't think they can, or they have a misunderstanding about what it is.
Sure. And part of what I spend a lot of my time doing is teaching within a master's program for students that want to make the transition into healthcare. And either prior to coming to our program, master's program, they either were in a different field or they were told no. You know, maybe they've applied to medical school or dental school a couple times and haven't been successful. And so what our platform allows at this master's program is for them to come in and take rigorous science courses, kind of in the intermediate. It's more rigorous than undergrad, but we're not in medical school. But it also allows for the simultaneous exposure to more one-on-one with faculty members, because it's a smaller program. And oftentimes, these students, as we've talked about, science can be such a weed out process, unfortunately, and it weeds out some of the best and brightest. Oftentimes they come the entrepreneurs, right? Some of those, doors put in place are standardized tests, right? In my world, that's the MCAT, which, has shown time and time again, if you are of higher socioeconomic status and can take it multiple times or have private tutors or take all the prep courses that you can, once you get above a certain score, it's really not indicative of how well you're going to do in medical school or what a great physician you might become. And so in essence, it can serve as a gatekeeping mechanism to the very people that we want more of, particularly in healthcare: women, people of color, because we know that will have better patient outcomes in the long run. So yes, it's something that on the graduate side, I'm very passionate about, and I love being a part of this biomedical master's program, because these students, they know what they want to do, right? They want to serve patients. They need the tool set and the time to get through the material and understand new study techniques that are grounded in neuroscience that they've never been exposed to before. So it's absolute delight to show them these study techniques, allow them time to implement it in their study routine, and then just see them take off over the course of a year or two in our program, and then achieve that, dream admissions into whatever health career that they aspire to.
I think about how many things, Anna, that people don't know they could do. In other words, you know, we do think about doctor, or we think about, you know, being a researcher, science researcher, or maybe we think about being a mathematician, math teacher, yes. But Anna, I know in your area, we don't even begin to know, you started the program with the idea that there were other things, and we think only of, you know, technology as coding.
This is the absolute bane of my existence. So, I mean, I also feel a little bit like an imposter because I don't have a STEM background specifically, right? So, I mean, I grew up thinking I never liked math, that I wasn't very good at it. It's not something I pursued. I have a liberal arts undergraduate. And so for me, when I wanted to work in tech, I went and I got a master's in informatics, which I wasn't even sure I was qualified. I was shocked that they accepted me. But now I understand that, you know, my brain is the perfect brain for technology. I mean, technology is great because there are so many new roles growing. So, in my technology past, I've been a user experience designer. I had never heard of that role before. I was a product manager for a long time. I had never heard of that role before. And now I'm head of product at a startup. What even is that? Who's even ever heard of a role like that? Technology is just this black box of all these amazing roles that you don't necessarily need to go to school for, that you can learn on the job, which is a lot of what I did as well. And so much of it depends on just, you know, getting that education and taking that leap into tech, but you would never even know that those roles are there. So I think to me, it is just so surprising. Even I learned, you know, a couple of years ago that even there are no programs to become a data scientist, which is one of the most important, you know, roles in tech. We're building these algorithms that can absolutely run our world. And, you know, there aren't necessarily degree paths for that. That, again, that's something you learn on the job, which is something I had no idea was true. So imagine, you know, wanting to do this kind of work, but just not, again, if you can't imagine it, if you don't understand it, you can't see yourself there, you don't know anyone else who does that role, how would you ever know that that's something that you would be great at? I think when we talked a while back, I talked about, you know, when in my hometown where I grew up, my really small town, doctors, dentists, lawyers, police officers, you know, teachers, and that was it. And you know, whatever else was on TV at the time, which is probably a bunch of lawyers, but yeah. And until you can see these roles, but then again, I think to like what Crystal said as well, see yourself represented in these roles, which is so, so, so important. There's so much out there, especially in technology.
When you mentioned data science, it made me think about some work that some math educators are doing to push for within K-12 schools to have a pathway towards data science. A lot of what it is now is calculus, and there's nothing wrong with calculus, but it's pushing towards calculus because that's what colleges are looking for. But to think about, you know, can we have multiple paths that can lead to a college, university, depending, you know, if individuals want to take that route. And so for you to mention in technology, like there's no that path towards data science, right? And it's such a major, major, major field. I think we do have to have some shifts that happen in the college area, but also that happens in the K-12 spaces as well.
Yeah,
and I've touched on this before in one of the Women in STEM series that we did, but there's also a lot of different ways that people learn. And one of the things that I was talking to one of the women in STEM that we'd interviewed that said that she had a lot of difficulty with understanding like theoretical concepts. And that is a lot of what like math is, right? And so and I would say even like tech or even like data science, all of those things, like I can't code to save my life, but if someone were able to teach it to me in a way that was very applicable, and then you could actually apply it to something that you care about, which is really what you do, I think, Anna, like you are taking all these skill sets that might be very theoretical, but then you're obviously applying it because otherwise what's the point? And so
yeah, exactly.
There's also a difference in the way that people are educated. I would say, especially around like high school, which is when you seriously start considering whether or not you want to stay in a math class. Like I had, it was me and another girl in a calculus class, and then she dropped out and I was the only girl left. And I think it was because it was just this idea of like, oh, this is too hard. And I don't understand it because it's just a bunch of numbers or concepts that are like just equations, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you were able to use that in some way that made it more interesting, which is how a lot of people learn, and I wouldn't just limit that to women, a lot of men learn in different ways too. then I think you would be able to hold on to more people or get them excited enough to continue in this career because they see the potential in how they could use this to actually do something they care about.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when I look at it, there are these, sometimes these spirals that are in there that, you know, are, we put a hierarchy. You know, if you're in academia, it's to become a full professor. You know, that's the pinnacle of everything that you've done is once you become full professor, you're supposed to be smarter than everybody else and have done more. And we put, you know, a doctor at the top of it, or we put, you know, we have all these things where we put something at the top. But what we don't realize is all of the other roles that are equally important. And I guess, you know, this spirals back to the idea that we were talking about a little bit ago. I think what we've done is, like with teachers, they still had to teach and they still had to take care of things at home. And that was just as important a role as somebody who was a lawyer having to appear in court, maybe even more important. You know, you'd think the courts probably could have adjusted. And so this wasn't Julia dinging your husband in any way, but it was, but it really is an interesting set of hierarchies as to what's a profession, what's not, who has time. You know, I think because we do a lot with art and science on our show, if you're an artist, people already have discounted you as being not that important in terms of your intellectual achievement and that kind of thing. And so I do think you're absolutely right, Anna, and that idea that we've got to show other kinds of possibilities and roles, and we have to see ourselves in those roles. Because just learning calculus, I learned it for physics, but I've never actually ever used it since. And I don't know too many people that do. And so, but learning how to do things so that I could do my taxes would be really, really helpful. And being a CPA would be a really great job. But it doesn't mean that I have to have advanced math to do it. So again, I think you guys are talking about something really important.
And also just not having access to the people who can show you that path. I mean, that'll always breed inequity. You know, if you don't have that connection that can make that connection for you or show you that role that exists, then you would never know. You would, and like tech jobs are absolute like pathways to, you know, high paying jobs, very in demand with a lot of freedom and a lot of flexibility. And again, if you aren't lucky enough to then just have those people in your life, then how do you find that role? How do you find that job? How do you get that salary? So it just needs to be more. I just want to I put out an infomercial about all the great roles in tech that you don't necessarily even have to have a specific degree for.
That's I think great. You can make that infomercial.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, Crystal, it's really hard. I get sometimes a lot of us can figure out technology or some of the science ones. Mathematics is always one I have a hard time figuring out what would I do with math by itself, but there's a lot, right?
There is a lot. And I think it, yeah, I mean, there's a lot that you can do with a mathematics degree. I believe in that math is in everything that we do. So yes, there are multiple career paths. I think it goes back to what Anna is saying, though, and I think what others have said is that, you know, understanding that this math connects to you in some way and it's something that you can use beyond passing a test. And it is this thing of, oh, if you can do math, somehow you're gifted in a certain way. Like, oh, you're good at math. You do math. But it's like, no, we can all do math in some way. And what counts as math? I mean, I'm sure in our homes tonight, we're all going to do some type of mathematical thinking when we're doing something. We're going to problem solve in some way. So I think part of it is, you know, trying to keep young people connected to mathematics is let them know and see that math is just not always what we're presenting in a textbook. So it's going to have to be some major shifts that happen, but there's much you can do with math. I mean, you can go, and I won't list out all the fields because you can really go into anything. I mean, math is the gatekeeper. It is a major gatekeeper to all careers. And so there is so much that you can do with it. And the doing of mathematics can look very, very different. The program that I did, we had some opportunity to work with a local organization called NXG Motorsports. And so to look at all the mathematics behind high-speed go-kart racing, I mean, you can look at the mathematics. We're doing some, we're working with a PhD student at IUPUI, and they're looking at music and science and math. So all the mathematics behind the music we listen to. So it's everywhere. And for me, you know, to see young people realize that, oh, math is in what I'm doing. It's in what I'm listening to. And now I can go create music. It's just a very rewarding, like to witness that is so rewarding and understand that it's just about making sure that they see how math is just connected to their everyday life. It is not this, oh, you know, it's only set aside for the certain group of people with that special gene. We all have that math gene in us.
I love that, Crystal. And I, you know, I always think about it in terms of that it is a language and a key.
Mm-hmm. And language are spoken in many different, there are multiple languages. So it's not a one way. And I love that. It's not like this. So people say, oh, the language of mathematics is universal. We all get it. Languages are different. I mean, math can be presented in different ways. It's created in different ways. And so people come to understand it in different ways. People present their understanding in different ways. So I think just really, you know, holding on to that we speak different languages, and mathematics can be, it's a language that's also spoken in many different ways.
That's just amazing. Jill, I know your area has become explosive in terms of neuroscience. It was kind of a misunderstood field. It probably is not well understood still, but I think people are understanding what it might be able to reveal. But I think of all the different roles now that are needed, besides being just a neuroscientist, but I mean, all the roles that are needed for that research to occur.
Yeah, I think it is a very interdisciplinary study. I mean, when I first started grad school, that's one of the things that I really liked about it is the reason I study neuroscience is because I'm interested in learning how the brain works. But then I'm using all of these, you know, microbiology, which is what Julia does. I probably have like overlapping techniques that she uses in her lab. I could probably learn and collaborate with her. There's a lot of other techniques and basically other organs and body systems that you could connect to. And there's a lot of overlap in what the brain does, and trying to understand it it requires you to do that. It requires you to think about everything else in the body, and then all of the different ways that you can answer those questions. So that's what I think I really like about it, is you can approach it from a lot of different angles, and you can probably use, you know, I know that we have people who are building, like they use coding to understand and simulate systems, which is beyond me, but they, you know, they can predict behavior. They can predict how someone is going to think or what they're going to say. And I think that's really cool. And that's just one example, but there's just similar to that, so many other ways that you can answer the same question. And that's exactly what you were talking about with like how you require or not require, but how you can approach something with a very broad range of skill sets. And that's similar to what we think about at the Da Vinci Pursuit, is you have artists and scientists, but there's a lot of overlap in that too. And I mean, there's a lot of scientists I know who think like artists, and that's why they're able to ask very specific questions. And I think that's really cool. And I think you require that too. I think that's similar to when you have to think about something from, I mean, even like in high school, when you're asked to think about questions, or like, you know, when you're trying to understand how something works and the way that you approach that, you can probably do it very scientifically or artistically. But to me, there's no real distinction there. I think that people in STEM fields overall are very creative. And I think that's a big plus for their careers.
I think that's a really great transition to to remind people that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore on your own, in conversation with others, any of the ideas that we've been exploring in the show. So I wanna kind of end up with looking at, from each of your perspectives, what, imagine that you're a coach, which you all are, coaching, but imagine you're a coach, and what would you tell someone that you're coaching in terms of what they should do if they wanted to pursue something in STEM? What kinds of things do they need to be ready for? Who would like to take that one on first?
So I was saying, I may jump in later, but I'll say definitely find a mentor. I mean, find your group, find your, my dean likes to call it the kitchen cabinet, find your crew, and that can walk with you through the process. You know, reach out to someone that is where you are, and, you know, shadow that person, talk to that person to learn about how they got to that point. And then when you're going through that process, have those that are with you to help you when you get to those difficult moments. As I'm sitting here, even, you know, talking, just thinking about it, it's important to have someone that you can sit under and learn from. And it can be multiple people, not just necessarily you go seek out one person. You can have multiple mentors in your circle, but just someone that's where you are or have been where you want to go, and really be open to listen and learn from them. And then just, you know, always remember your why. And when you hit those tough moments, just remember that why you want to be in that space, and that you as an individual is going to change the space when you get there. So if you don't show up, that space is always going to be missing something, because there'll never be another you. So that's something I will tell them as well.
And just piggybacking off of Crystal, who highlighted the importance of mentoring, going alongside of that is starting to identify maybe not the job title within STEM. You know, I want to be an endocrinologist or a respiratory therapist, right? A lot of people don't start out like that, but identifying what you want to bring to the table every day that's uniquely you. And that's where that mentorship can really help identify some of those things that you don't even see in yourself, right? And we all just talked about how the intersection of art and science is creativity. And I would wager to say we all have a bit of that creative, you know, gene in us. And it's probably expressed though slightly differently. And that's the beautiful spectrum, you know, that is STEM. But it's those mentors from a variety of fields, hopefully, that can help you identify some of those maybe underlying traits that you didn't even realize you brought to the table that could be so helpful, as Crystal said, to help you stand out within the field, really contribute something to whatever STEM field, you know, you end up in.
Great.
Yeah, I want you guys both to say that to me. I love everything you said. I would say that, and I would go just a little extra, go a little further and say it's I think networking is so important. And not only networking just to like build your network, but to meet people who have different roles, and how did they get to that role, and what do they like about that role? What would they do differently? I think one of the hardest things for me to unlearn going into tech from like coming just how I learned to learn in school and how I have to learn now is that there isn't just a right way to do something. I mean, technology and building tech products and solving is just about solving problems, and there's never a right way to do it. There's never a way that it's necessarily been done before. It's all about trying different things. And so I think going back to that creativity, if you're a creative problem solver, there's absolutely nothing you can't do in tech. I truly believe that.
I have probably nothing to add to that, because I liked all those answers, and that I think having a good mentor is actually, I'll just broaden that out to say having the right people around you in your work environment is probably the most important thing that you should be focused on. For me, I think I learned that along the way, that it's not just a mentor who can teach you the right things and who is well known. It's also mentors. And like Julia said, that this could come from anyone can be a mentor, regardless of what position or position in their career that they're in, but that they add something of value to your experience rather than take something away from that, if that makes any sense. And this is in line with Mark, you mentioned, you know, like the systemic changes that I especially know about, like in academic institutions, but I think they exist everywhere, but they're not going anywhere. And it's probably going to take a while to fix or improve those things. So I think to be able to navigate that and have a positive experience where you're not, where you're not either pushed out or end up leaving the field, would be to have people who are not only able to teach you, but support you. And like Anna said, to have a network that will then help you keep advancing in your career. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you're hitting on is how important that role is of having people who are positive, but not to the level that they don't tell you the truth. But what I mean is being around thinking you as an asset and what can they add to you, rather than thinking of what are the deficits that you have. We have way too many people that are already thinking but I think it's the asset thinking. Anna?
I had someone say to me recently, so we were meeting and she said, do you want me to be your cheerleader right now? Do you want me to be a mentor, or do you want me to poke holes in what you're saying? And she was very specific with me, and I chose poke holes, but I should have chose cheerleader. But it was, no one has ever said that to me before, and I really appreciated it. She basically asked me, like, how do you want me to show up to this meeting? And that's what I can be for you. And I like that, and now I want to steal it and use it with other people. It was really, really valuable.
That's really great. All of you, have there been moments where you had one of those people you were just talking about? Was there somebody you could point to, or somebodies that you could point to along your path that really made a difference for you? You don't have to name them, but if you want to talk about that for a minute, that would be great.
I've had several. Most of my, I guess it probably would start with my kindergarten teacher, and she's a vivid memory. My middle school teacher, I had middle school math teacher, and then I had several high school math teachers that person in those during that the years where I would have decided whether or not I wanted to go in mathematics or not, study mathematics in college. And then along the way, I was really blessed. I mean, through every path, I mean, I had people that were telling me no, but I also had people that were saying you can do this. And so in college, the same thing, I had really great professors. I just, you know, I had one person telling me, you know, you can't do this. But outside of that, I just always had really great teachers. And then my mentor, who was a great mentor for my master's degree, my PhD, and part of my academic career before she passed away, was just a huge influence on my life. And that was just extremely vital and important. So again, I'm blessed to just have several people who have been that for me and are still that for me.
Going off of Crystal, my three that come to mind are all educators in some level as well. And I think what motivates me is feeling indebted, you know, to their generosity and willingness to help me. The first one was one of my first teachers, and what made kind of my call to diversity, equity, inclusion just part of who I am. She was a woman of color that taught me from first grade all the way to eighth grade, because she was the teacher. Her name is Patrice Payne, and she taught students with learning disabilities. And so when I had that identified in myself at a first grader, she was the woman that taught me how to read when it was just a world of letters floating all over the place for me. And then my second champion, I'll call her, would be my college professor who said, you could do this, Julia, like you could be a professor, like that you have it in you, you know, and her name is Dr. Nancy Neckvasil at St. Mary's College. And to this day, I have a mentor just down the hallway here who helped recruit me into this position. His name is Dr. Jonathan Lowery. And depending on the day, he's either a cheerleader or someone that's poking holes in arguments, as Anna said. And really, it's those three people that have so helped me get where I am into such a fulfilling job that it feels like a calling, and it motivates me to help others find their why and how to get there.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think I've had so many educators, for sure. I think, you know, the people that have been the most, I think, meaningful for me in my career are the people who've always challenged me to do more and push for and be more. I had a professor in grad school who she was disappointed in my work because she knew I was better, which is like the hardest feedback I've ever had to take, but like some of the best feedback I've ever gotten. Because it's like, I'm disappointed in you because I know you are better than what I see here. And I think for me, one thing, you know, like, and I feel like the women in tech community and the underrepresented group in tech has been a huge source of I don't know. It's like feminist technology Twitter. It's just like absolutely incredible just to like, just hear the experience of other people, you know, going through disrupting big systems. But for me, when I was really young, you know, my dad, you know, he was in the military and he was, you know, grew up really poor. And he told me this story that when he was in the military, he saw the officers in the military and he started to understand that the only difference between him and the officers was education. And he said, education is, he's like, I understand that that's the only difference between me and them. They're not better than me. They're not smarter than me. They're not greater than me. They just have an education. And so it always instilled in me that, you know, you can always learn. You can always get better. You can always better yourself. And I took a lot of heart to that. No one's intrinsically better than you. You can always outread them if you need to. So that was probably the biggest lesson for me.
I'm going to say, if anyone who knows me will probably know or see those coming, but my mom and my two sisters, we literally grew up just four women in the household for a really long time. And I think that that really shapes who the kind of person you become. So for me, you know, my mom is a single mother and she was born and brought up in India. I was born there, but I was essentially brought up here. But it's very clear to me that the reason why we were here is because of our education. I mean, it's you can be educated in India. That's not really the problem. But I think there's always this, it's not really education to have a career or advance yourself. It's just an education to have it, or often to just marry into a good family. I mean, that's the reality of it. And so for me also, just like Anna, growing up, it was always your education comes first. And so she did a lot. Her and my sisters have essentially, like, we've just kind of worked with each other and made sure we're always focused on education, career, making sure we're growing. And so I've always kind of had those three as like cheerleaders, which is great growing up. And, but in addition to that, I will say that my first two teachers here in the United States when I was in fourth and fifth grade were very, badass woman. And I even like as an 8 year old, I was just like, wow, you can do stuff like this and you can teach like this. And this is so great. So I think they kind of shaped the way that I presented myself to other people, even in this country, especially. But I think those were like formative people, but I've always had people, I would say a lot of women, especially, but the first lab I worked in was in a cardiology lab, and my mentor there, he was a really good mentor. And I think that it really helps to have all of these role models where you can learn the kind of mentor, but also the kind of like person you want to eventually be and the way you should be mentoring other people.
I want to thank all four of you for really an inspiring conversation about mentorship and how we can support one another and encourage. And I encourage our audience to think about ways in which they can be encouraging someone to be all that they possibly can be, and to not see their deficits, but see their assets as something that we can move forward with. You'll find pictures of our projects and about our guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit's website at thedaVinciPursuit.com. We'll be back next week with another exploration of the curiosities between the intersection of art and science. And until then, I'm Mark Kiesling.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.